This is Encounter on VOA. Here's Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. On this edition of the program, can Washington pursue a campaign of maximum pressure and agree to talk with Pyongyang without preconditions? Hello again, I'm Carol Castiel. South Korea opened the door for the North to participate in the Winter Olympics, and the North walked through. Now, North Korea has opened the door for South Korean President Moon Jae-in to travel North to visit Pyongyang. He has wanted dialogue with the North since taking office last year. But up until recently, that approach was at odds with Washington's maximum economic and diplomatic pressure policy. However, Vice President Mike Pence told reporters in Seoul that the United States is, in fact, open to talks without preconditions with nuclear North Korea. Previously, the United States insisted that North Korea commit itself to denuclearization before negotiations could commence. Pence's comments provided a little more leverage for South Korea in its outreach to the North and could reduce potential strains in the U.S.-South Korea alliance. But Kim Jong-un has given no sign of being ready to talk to Washington, and Vice President Pence has made it clear that the United States will keep escalating sanctions pressure until the North takes steps toward giving up its nukes. In fact, Vice President Pence was to meet North Korean officials on the sidelines of the Winter Olympics February 10th, but it was scrapped by the North following Pence's criticism of Pyongyang's human rights record. Western intelligence agencies say that North Korea's nuclear and ballistic missile programs will soon be able to threaten the continental United States. Well, with us to discuss the next phase of dealing with nuclear North Korea are two distinguished analysts. Bruce Klengner is Senior Research Fellow for Northeast Asia at the Asian Studies Center at the Heritage Foundation, and that's a conservative think tank here in Washington. And James Schoaf, he's Senior Fellow in the Asia Program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, a think tank also based here in Washington. And both gentlemen join me here at the VOA Broadcast Center in Washington. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having us.
Great to be here.
Well, Bruce Klengner, let me begin with you. We have the Olympic Games in Pyeongchang. They've provided this impetus, in a sense, for trying to diplomatically reduce this threat from North Korea's nuclear program. What's your take on South Korea's outreach, and does it undercut the so-called maximum pressure approach by the United States, or do you see the two being reconciled?
I think they are working in concert with each other. Alliance managers in both countries have emphasized that there's constant contact between the two of them, constant coordination. And the Trump policy is maximum pressure and engagement, though clearly the emphasis is on the pressure in response to North Korea's repeated violations of international law, U.S. law, and U.N. resolutions. So I think South Korea is more eager for engagement than perhaps the U.S., but whether it's a good cop, bad cop policy or simply, you know, one side has a different set of priorities, but I think the two countries are working very well together.
Are they working very well together, James Schoaf?
Well, I think they're trying to give that impression, and I think they're trying to work well together. The fundamental problem, though, is that the Moon government is a liberal government that I think believes at its core, certainly when you talk to some of their advisors and people in the inner circle there, that the strategy of pressure on North Korea has failed in their mind, that in many ways we're at this point now with a much larger nuclear and missile program in North Korea because of pressure, and that they really want to lean more forward with engagement. But I think President Moon is fairly pragmatic and understands that he can't simply cut himself loose from the alliance with the United States, and he really loses all his leverage if he tries to kind of unilaterally engage with the North. So he has, I think, consistently hung in there with some U.S. priorities on pressure, on participating in military exercises rather than trying to convince the United States to stop them completely. So there's been some flexibility, I think, on both sides, where our natural tendencies are to go in slightly opposite directions with our strategy. But it's going to be tested in the near future.
Back to you, Bruce Klengner, to comment on this on-again, off-again meeting that was supposed to have taken place between Vice President Pence and
the North Korean delegation. I believe he was supposed to have met with Kim Jong-un's sister, who was his envoy to the Olympics. She caused quite a stir. Was that naive, or what was that all about?
Well, when the U.S. revealed that it had agreed several weeks ago to have this meeting, that was quite a surprise to me. Now, on the flight over, Vice President Pence had been fairly coy about whether he would meet with North Koreans. There was constant questions from the media, and he was just simply saying, well, we'll see what happens. And then when we saw he and the North Koreans in the VIP delegation during the opening ceremonies, he was very aloof. He didn't even acknowledge the existence of the North Koreans. So that seemed to indicate that there was no way that there was going to be a meeting or that it was even being contemplated, because Pence's mission seemed to be a counter to what was seen as a North Korean charm offensive or propaganda ploy. So then when we find out that 2 hours after that non-meeting in the VIP box that they were scheduled to have a meeting, I found that quite surprising. So North Korea again refused the meeting or walked away from the meeting. So, you know, to all the people who say the U.S. should try something new, like talking to North Korea, should drop preconditions, the U.S. has been trying. Here we have Pence, who's a very strong critic of North Korea, but he was willing to meet with someone who's on the U.S. sanctions list for human rights violations. So if you talk to diplomats in both this administration and the previous administration, they said they've tried repeatedly to meet with North Koreans, and it's always the North Koreans that reject the meetings.
How do you see that, James Shoaf? Was it North Korea, or was it perhaps naive to think that after denouncing North Korea, its rights record, which is horrendous, and then, you know, basically denouncing the North, ignoring the delegation. Again, I'm not defending in any way, shape, or form North Korea, but is it surprising to you that they then backed out?
Well, there's a couple different things to consider here, and the first gets back to this issue of tension between Seoul and Washington on what's the right approach, because I don't think Pence would have even contemplated a meeting with the North Koreans during this Olympic opening ceremonies unless President Moon had not asked him to or tried to kind of facilitate that. So Moon is trying to push the U.S. and North Korea together because he wants to create conditions appropriate for a summit meeting with Kim Jong-un in Pyongyang or whatever to move the agenda forward on North-South relations. He knows he needs the U.S. and North Korea to at least be engaged in some kind of dialogue to help create those conditions, because North Korea will not talk about nuclear weapons with the South. Their argument is, we have to talk to the U.S. about this. That's who our enemy is and the one threatening us with nukes. So Pence is kind of doing this as a favor. On the other hand, he wants to maintain, counter the charm offensive and maintain this pressure campaign. So they went into it with the idea, we're going to deliver a tough message consistent with our public message to demonstrate that we're not kidding around here. So it really wasn't an opportunity for talks that sometimes the Trump administration characterizes it as, and the North has, you know, foregone that opportunity. There was no real constructive dialogue that was going to happen there. And this gets to the question about negotiations versus talking. And the Trump administration is adamant that we're not going to enter negotiations until the North accepts that the beginning point of those negotiations is that the goal is denuclearization, and it's how we get there. And that's understandable as a premise, but at least the U.S. seems to have begun to open up some room for the potential for talking about negotiations with no preconditions or with fewer preconditions. That's the real question, is can we get to that point or not? Sometimes we see signs that the administration is willing to do that. Other times, less so. But so far, North Korea has seemed not so interested in either talking or negotiating.
Back to you, Bruce Klingner. What can you tell us about South Korean public opinion vis-a-vis this approach by President Moon? Are they on board with him? Is there a generational split? Are the older generation, you know, maybe more with him and the younger perhaps less? How do you see the demographics?
You know, there's concern in the U.S. about how far fast Moon Jae-in may pursue engagement. And we have memories of the two previous progressive presidents, Kim Dae-jung and Noh Myoon. And so during those two administrations, there was a push for really non-reciprocal, non-conditional engagement with the North. But I think Moon faces a lot more constraints, both internationally and domestically, than either of his two progressive predecessors. Internationally, there are these sanctions that are required to be implemented. So South Korea had to ask for special dispensation from both the United Nations and the U.S. to allow some of the North Koreans to come into South Korea. But also beyond those sanctions, domestically, the public is much more wary of engaging North Korea. They're not only skeptical of whether it would be effective, but they're much more angry angry at North Korea, given the two deadly attacks on South Korea in 2010, which occurred after the last progressive president was in office. And Moon even faced some criticism for sort of his unilateral actions on the Olympics. The public pointed out he's sort of doing what Moon criticized Park Geun-hye for doing. And the fairness issue is very important in South Korea, where a number of South Korean women on the hockey team were basically kicked off to make room for North Koreans, and the public saw that as very unfair.
So to you, James Cho, for your take on public opinion in South Korea vis-a-vis this approach by Moon and opening the Olympics to the North and so forth, and how that's affected perceptions.
Well, this issue of restraint on President Moon, I think, is a real issue in terms of the international sanctions are there, so he has very few carrots that he can offer unilaterally by himself to the North to entice some kind of cooperation. In the past, they've opened up special economic zones, industrial parks in the North, resort at Mount Kumgang to facilitate trade and interaction. He can't do any of those things because of international sanctions are much more strict than they used to be. Bruce mentioned the public perception has kind of soured or dimmed. There's still plenty of support for the so-called sunshine policy, you know, the old Aesop fable of you can get a traveler to take off his coat by sunshine as opposed to cold, harsh wind. He'll just hunker down more in his coat in that regard. So that philosophy is still there. But he also came onto the scene later. His election was much later than Prime Minister Abe in Japan and Xi Jinping, the leader in China, who developed personal relationships with President Trump very early in the game. I think Washington did not really see Seoul or Moon as a player or a partner in this game with North Korea until much later on. And so now he's finally on this main stage. He's at least in the driver's seat, and he knows this is his window. And I think he's trying to steer North Korea a little bit towards the U.S. and the U.S. a little bit towards North Korea so that that can give him some options bilaterally with the North. He'll throw whatever carrots he can in that mix, but there's got to be some reciprocity. There's got to be some sign from North Korea that they're willing to be a part of this. Otherwise, I think it's going to be very short-lived.
We'll have more in just a moment, but first, you're listening to Encounter on The Voice of America. My guests are Bruce Klingner. He's Senior Research Fellow for Northeast Asia at the Asian Studies Center at the Heritage Foundation, and James Cho, from whom you just heard. He's Senior Fellow in the Asia Program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. And we're discussing the prospects of talks among Washington, Seoul, and Pyongyang as a way to thwart Pyongyang's nuclear ambitions. And this is a reminder that our Encounter podcast is available for free download on iTunes. You can find that download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/encounter. You may also follow me on Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA or connect with us on Facebook. Here's a shout out to a loyal listener, Ivan Joe Kofi of the Leadership Center in Lafia, a town in central Nigeria. If you want to hear your name on the air, please send an email to encounter@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. Well, back to you, Bruce Klingner. We've been at these microphones so many times talking about the threat from North Korea. Summarize for us, characterize for us. I've kind of lost count of all the nuclear tests and ballistic missile tests Pyongyang has conducted. How do they stand right now, their nuclear capacity?
You know, in my view, there's been a tendency over the years to downplay or dismiss the North Korean threat, either because it's politically inconvenient or people just feel that this little country that is often the subject of cartoons or late-night humor could possibly complete things. In the 90s, there were many who dismissed that they were working on a plutonium nuclear weapon. During the George W. Bush administration, many dismissed that they had an HU program until you could no longer deny it. And sort of the list goes on and on. But right now, the best estimate, and it's difficult to get information even within the intelligence community, but we think they probably have at least 30 nuclear weapons. Some parts of the intelligence community apparently think 60. And we're pretty sure we know that they have nuclear weapons for their medium-range missiles so that all of South Korea and Japan are already under a nuclear threat. It's not theoretical. It's not in the future. North Korea is also continuing to work on intermediate-range missiles that could hit our key base in Guam, as well as the ICBMs, actually two different or even perhaps more versions of an ICBM. They've demonstrated those missiles can reach all the way down to Florida, the entire continental U.S., and the debate right now is whether the intermediate-range and the intercontinental ballistic missiles have nuclear weapons for them or whether it's within a handful of months, as the CIA director said, or within a year. But you know, they're very close to completing the ability to target the entire American homeland with a nuclear weapon.
So, James Shove, anything to add or subtract to that?
Well, I would just highlight that 2017 was a big year for North Korea's nuclear missile program in terms of the range that they were able to demonstrate with their systems. They kind of rolled out a whole new line. We make automobiles, and only every 5 or 6 years they really revamp and roll out a whole new version. Their medium range and their long range were all new designs, and the nuclear test that they conducted demonstrated a much stronger, more powerful nuclear weapon as well. They're probably on the cusp of beginning to develop larger numbers of reliable nuclear-capable missiles that will range a variety of U.S. cities and American allies. So I think that's really driven this sense of maximum pressure is not just a slogan. The pressure has really increased, and China has been on board voting for these sanctions, and even Russia in the UN when U.S. diplomats and Japanese diplomats and others go around Southeast Asia, Middle East, etc. They are promoting the enforcement of these sanctions so that more and more avenues for North Korea to earn foreign currency are cut off. There's some sign that this is beginning to have an impact in North Korea. Perhaps that's part of what was behind Kim Jong-un offering this idea of a summit and a charm offensive in the first place. But the sense of time, and the time is running out, is kind of a fundamental aspect here in the debate in Washington, with some saying we need to add military pressure to the economic pressure piece sooner rather than later because of this time is running out, and others saying, you know, no, let sanctions play out a little longer. That might give us some opportunity on this dialogue side to make some real progress. So one way or the other, this is coming to a head relatively soon.
Turning to you, Bruce Clenger, because James Shove alluded to what has been called some kind of a bloody nose strike, a preemptive strike. Talk about that among members of the administration. Where does that stand right now? And do you think that would be wise? Should that, in fact, be contemplated?
Right. You know, for decades, U.S. strategy has always included retaliatory or preemptive strikes, either one in response to an attack. The second is if you have good intelligence, you may attack an opponent if you believe they are about to attack you, particularly with nuclear weapons. And that's consistent with international law and the UN Charter. What we've been hearing from the Trump administration in the last year is what's called a preventive attack, where even if you don't feel you're in imminent danger, you conduct a military attack to prevent them from completing an ICBM. And as North Korea completes not only the missile part, but this H-bomb, not only kind of 1945-level atomic weapons, but a hydrogen bomb, 10 or more times more powerful than the 1945 bombs, it's led to an advocacy by some, including within the administration, on a preventive attack. I think virtually all, if not all, of the Korea watchers in Washington who have been following it for some time think a preventive attack is not a good idea.
And what's your take on that, James Shove? I don't imagine that the Moon regime was too happy about of a so-called preventive strike.
No. And as a matter of fact, Moon has said that the United States can't attack North Korea without our permission or without consulting us and us agreeing to that. And to some extent, I think he's right. We certainly can't sustain an attack on North Korea without collaboration, cooperation with South Korea. We could launch an individual strike, but it would really damage the alliance and the sense of trust between the United States and South Korea. Presumably, Kim Jong-un would retaliate against South Korea in some shape or form, possibly even involve Japan. Now, it's interesting, Japan has been verbally supportive of the idea of all options on the table, but you know, I think their belief is we at least need to show support of this military option as a means of continuing to apply pressure on North Korea. But I think in part that's because they view a possible preventive strike as something pretty far off in the future, not something really imminent that could happen soon. So I agree with Bruce, a preventive strike, certainly it's not needed now. I don't think we're at a situation where we're at this imminent crisis where North Korea can threaten multiple U.S. cities with simultaneous nuclear attack. And so we have time to let this play out, especially the sanctions piece, and we have to cooperate with South Korea on this. But the two things that worry me are proliferation of nuclear weapons by North Korea. The more we ostracize them and cut them off from the rest of the world, the less stake they have in any kind of stability in the world. So what might prevent them from selling a nuclear weapon to a terrorist group? And then the second thing is what I call Kim Jong-un's last week. If for whatever reason he is facing rebellion or collapse internally or some kind of external attack, etc., would he be tempted to just launch an all-out nuclear attack just in spite to kind of take America down with him? I don't know. And the argument for a preventive strike is, well, if he's going to do that, potentially at some point, stop him from developing his capabilities, then the sooner the better in the long run. But I agree with Bruce. It's a bad theory. Deterrence can work, and keeping our solidarity with our allies is critical to being effective in this case, and that's what we need to focus on.
So on that note, back to talks again. So back to you, Bruce Clenger. When do you think these talks between South and North Korea could begin after the Olympics? And will South Korea agree to hold joint military exercises with the United States, which were delayed, you know, in order to accommodate the Olympics and the North Korea's participation in them?
On the second point first is, when I was in Seoul a few weeks ago and met with senior officials, and they all were very reassuring that the exercises were merely postponed, they weren't canceled. And certainly the U.S. would push that or insist on that. And then if we do these exercises, and we should point out that North Korea is doing its annual military exercises right now, they're called the winter training cycle. They go from December through March or April every year, and no one seems to call on them to suspend or constrain their military exercises. But the exercises, we'll see how North Korea responds. Will it complain and use it as justification for launching more missiles and doing more nuclear tests, or will they try to maintain this charm offensive? Now, in the inter-Korean talks, they'll be at a senior level, and they're trying to agree on an agenda. I think one thing that South Korea should push for is the venue. Why is it automatically being seen as in Pyongyang? We've had two inter-Korean summits in Pyongyang. Kim Jong-il, when he was leader, promised to visit Seoul at an appropriate time. I think South Korea should say, this one should be in South Korea. It shouldn't look like, once again, South Korea subjugating itself and going unto the North. It should have it in the South. If not in Seoul, maybe the island of Jeju, which is known as the island of peace. You know, they may be able to control security and demonstrations there better. So I think that's one thing that should be at the top of the agenda for South Korea.
And James Shove, how do you see these talks going forward? Should they even take place? And to what extent, you know, those military exercises, will they in any way scuttle them, the U.S. and South Korea military exercises?
Luckily, the exercises that are planned are, on the scale of how these exercises go, relatively small scale, in the sense that they're primarily command post exercises. You don't see mass amounts of hardware and troops marching this way and that. So I think there's a good chance that as long as we signal ahead of time, look, this is coming, don't be surprised, to the North, and it's relatively low key, that won't necessarily end everything, and that there's some potential for momentum to carry forward in a North-South dialogue. Frankly, if Kim Jong-un is smart, he would really continue to reach out to the South. By August, we have really large-scale exercises planned. And what Kim Jong-un wants is for Moon to have to go to Washington or call up Trump and say, please, can we cancel this next exercise? Because I don't want to ruin this chance to have North-South dialogue. That would put real pressure on the U.S.-South Korea relationship in that regard. I'm not sure if Kim Jong-un has it all figured out that well. But frankly, what I want to do is I want to speed up the North-South dialogue if I'm the United States. The worst thing in my mind is that we have a trickle of meaningless symbolic North-South interaction. You know, a dance troupe goes from the North to the South 1 month. It's 4 months later, an orchestra is going to go from the South to the North. And that puts all this pressure for the South to tell the U.S. to keep calm, stand down, don't do certain things that could ruin this. But meanwhile, there's no real substance there. I'd rather have Moon say, let's have family reunions. Let's have general officer talks to reduce tension on the border. Let's send students back and forth to each other's universities. Let's send NGOs back and forth to do science projects or environmental cleanup, things that don't contradict current sanctions, but that really open the floodgates of interaction between the South and the North. I think Kim Jong-un is going to say no. I think the North is ultimately going to disappoint the South because they don't want to risk that level of interaction. And then finally, we can kind of call Kim Jong-un's bluff and get back to our policy. So if I'm Washington, I want to do whatever I can to get that going quicker rather than later.
All right. Well, I'm afraid on that note, that's all the time we have on this edition of Encounter. I'd like to thank my guests, Bruce Clenger. He's Senior Research Fellow for Northeast Asia at the Asian Studies Center at the Heritage Foundation, and James Shove, Senior Fellow in the Asia Program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Gentlemen, thank you so much for coming in, sharing your insights.
No, thanks for having us.
Thank you, Carol.
Encounter was produced in Washington. Thanks to Rebecca Ward for booking our guests. Our engineer was Justin Thwaites. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Encounter on The Voice of America.